not to tell you things. Everybody knows. Right? Everybody's out of work, or just scared of losing their job. Dollar by the nickel. Banks are going up. Shops are running. Shops are running wild. No one anywhere. We know the air is our food is under control. That worse than that. We're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy. We don't go out anymore. We sit in a house and go in the world and living room and go all in and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living room. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel belt and radio. I won't say anything. Well, I'm not going to leave you. I want you to say. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write these comments. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. All I know is first you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being, God damn it. My life has value. So I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now. Go to the window, open it, stick your head out, and yell, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. I want you to...
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts out with reinventing the U.S. Michael Lynn lays out how the U.S. has reinvented itself economically and politically a number of times as a result of new technology. He sees a pattern of each new technology overwhelming the political and regulatory system, with the U.S. government lagging a generation or two behind the technologically induced economic changes. It takes a crisis or a war or both to overthrow the old regime and usher in the new. Michael is interviewed by Terrence McNally, a journalist and radio host. And then after that, British Columbia rejects tar sands pipeline.
Today's guest, Michael Lind, has written an economic history of the United States in his new book, Land of Promise. Lind lays out a pattern in which the U.S. has reinvented itself economically and politically a number of times, based usually on the emergence of new technologies, from wind and water to steam, to electricity and internal combustion, and finally, the computer. Each new dominant technology overwhelms the existing political and regulatory system, and American government lags a generation or two behind this technology-induced economic change. And he says it takes a crisis or a war or both to overthrow the old regime and usher in the new. When the U.S. economy has flourished, Lynn argues, government and business, labor, and universities have worked together as partners in a project of economic nation building. Today, as the United States struggles to emerge from the Great Recession, Land of Promise says that Americans, since the earliest days of the Republic, have repeatedly reinvented the American economy and have the power to do so again. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Michael Lind is a co-founder of the New America Foundation, where he is policy director of the Economic Growth Program. He's taught at Harvard and Johns Hopkins. He writes for the Financial Times, the New York Times, and has a weekly column at Salon. He's written several books, including Up from Conservatism, Why the Right is Wrong for America, The Next American Nation, Vietnam, The Necessary War, and his latest, Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States, as well as several volumes of fiction and poetry and even a children's book. Welcome again, Michael Lind, to Free Forum.
Thanks.
As you know, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So could you briefly talk about your path to the work you're doing today? Not so much why you wrote this book, we'll get into that, but more sort of the bigger path of your life to flesh out that brief bio from your point of view.
Right,
and
right.
Feel free to cite mentors, turning points, moments of decision.
Well, I come out of the southwestern Texas wing of the New Deal tradition, of the Rooseveltian, New Deal Great Society, LBJ tradition. I grew up in Austin, Texas, fifth-generation native. And like many in my generation, when the New Deal coalition broke apart, basically when I was in high school, You had the kind of the emergence of this new party system with Reagan Republicans on the one hand, and the progressives sort of went in a different direction, at least on some issues, than they had in the period between the 1930s and the 1960s. And so, like a lot of stranded New Dealers, I found myself a neoconservative back when that meant paleoliberal, that is, Kennedy Johnson Democrat. And the chief thing that distinguished us from others in the Democratic Party, it was foreign policy. We were hawkish on the Soviet Union until the end of the Cold War, at which point one of my mentors, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, mm-hmm. basically, you know, abandoned what were then called the neocons, who took on a quite different coloration after the end of the Cold War. You know, we supported a strong social insurance system, universal programs, but also were opposed to race-based affirmative action for practical reasons. We thought it would divide the white working class from people of color and undermine the liberal coalition, which arguably it has done to some degree. I was, you know, sort of a rising star among these neoconservatives. I was a protege of William F. Buckley Jr., who had pretty moved pretty far to the center by the end of the Reagan years. I worked at the National Interest for our publisher, Irving Kristol, who's sometimes described as the godfather of the neoconservatives.
Right.
But I thought we were carrying on the old FDR, LBJ, Harry Truman, Hubert Humphrey tradition when, in fact, by the early 1990s, the neocons had thrown themselves in with the Republican Party and were teaming up with the religious right, the National Rifle Association, instead of welcoming the end of the Cold War as a way to go back to being an ordinary country, you know, in a world governed by international institutions, which is what Daniel Patrick Moynihan and also Jean Kirkpatrick may surprise some of your listeners. But she was one of the ones who wanted a less hawkish foreign policy after the 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall. So the second wave neocons threw in their lot with the radical right.
Right.
And I had a rather nasty public breaking with them, which included an expose in the New York Review of Books in 1995 of the Reverend Pat Robertson's theories explaining world history in terms of the machinations of Freemasons, Jewish bankers, Satan, various other shady characters.
Can't get much shadier than that.
Yeah, so to this day, I'm sort of considered an apostate from the right. Although, as I say, as a neocon, I was never really a conservative. I was a paleoliberal. And right now, I would describe myself as a progressive. In the Rooseveltian tradition, which I as I explained in the book, there are other traditions on the left, obviously.
Right, right.
But that's one strain.
Okay. That's good. I think that sets things up well. And that's where that Up From Conservatism book
right.
comes about, is following your New York Review of Books article was your first book, right?
No, the first book was called The Next American Nation,
oh, right.
which was a study of changing conceptions of racial identity in American history. But Up From Conservatism, it was my critique of the direction that the right was taking. And I have to say that now in 2012, you know, really about 15 years after all of this, a little longer, one of my allies after another at the time on the right followed my lead and broke with them. Frank Fukuyama, Francis Fukuyama, Andrew Sullivan, most recently David Frum, George W. Bush's speechwriter. He and I were intellectual rivals throughout the Bush years. We're now friends. He was kicked out of the American Enterprise Institute. They locked him out of his office very unceremoniously, told him to get out when he had made a few minor criticisms of the Republican Party. So I think in retrospect, I started an exodus of thinkers from the center-right to the center-left, or at least the center.
And one thing that you point out is that thing where you said before they'd thrown in completely with the religious right and so on, that race-based affirmative action and so on might split the working class, the white working class, from the African-American working class, the minority working class. If it didn't make what you said might happen, it has certainly been seized upon and used by the right to act to accelerate that process.
Oh yeah, definitely. And you see the same thing with immigration policy, where it was the position of Robert Bartley Jr., the late editor of the Wall Street Journal. He wanted to have a constitutional amendment saying we shall have open borders. And so they're actually, when your listeners, you know, really ought to know this, up until the late 1990s, there was a very strong position on the center left that said you cannot have high minimum wages, a generous welfare state, very strong unions if you have weak labor markets. And if you have a divided workforce so that employers can pit workers against each other on the basis of race and ethnicity and region and so on. So for pro-labor solidarity reasons, there was always a desire to limit immigration to the point that it did not depress wages at the bottom, and also that you do not gratuitously add to the already very deep existing differences between the white working class and the African-American working class and Latinos and others. And for that reason, there was a strain of the Democratic Party associated with the liberal integrationists, including Bayard Rustin, the organizer of the March on Washington, as well as Martin Luther King Jr. Sometimes he sort of went back and forth. But King, his whole idea of a poor people's budget was that you would bring in the poor whites, particularly the poor whites of the South, who had been victims not of the racial caste system, but they were victims of the Southern economic system, even if they were racist themselves, right? It's not a matter of attitude. It's a matter of your position in the structure of society. And particularly if in my native South, the elite, you know, for centuries has governed by dividing and ruling.
Of course.
So anything that exacerbates, you know, this sense of different identities tends to weaken the cause of ordinary people and of organized labor. We lost that argument. By the end of the 1990s, you could no longer criticize high levels of unskilled immigration. You can no longer criticize race-based policies as opposed to, say, class-based policies.
Right.
And the reason for that was that by that time, Democratic strategists had written off the white working class. And, as they are doing again in this election.
And basically, had seen that the demographics of Latino population increase was working in their favor.
Well, yes and no. That's kind of a myth. The reason the Democrats have done fairly well in the congressional election 2008 and then in the Obama's election, it's an influx of upscale whites plus Latinos. So the Democrats now have picked up a lot of the former so-called Rockefeller Republicans from the northeastern Midwestern states. Now, this is a dubious benefit from the point of view of us old-fashioned New Dealers, because the Rockefeller Republicans, they bring their traditionally enlightened attitudes towards race.
On social issues.
Towards reproductive freedom. I mean, they've always been for contraception and availability back to the early 20th century. On environmentalism, they've always been the champions. But they tend to be fairly conservative on economics. And they think we're spending too much on Social Security and Medicare and that taxes are too high. So you can see why some of us have sort of floated between the two coalitions.
Yeah.
Although, by contemporary standards, I'm center left, if not slightly radical in some ways.
It's crazy enough.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
You who build all the guns, you that build all the planes, you that build the big bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks. I just want you to know I can see. Never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes and you turn. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. I see through your eyes and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my dreams. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled, a fear to bring children into the world, for threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. Let me ask you one question.
So let's move up to this book. How did this book happen is a common question, but I have a feeling that this is, for you, Michael, a major tome. This is more than just another book.
Yeah, this is something I've been thinking about for really a quarter of a century, you know, back to my earliest years in politics, because I was interested in what were the deeper roots of this New Deal tradition that I identified with. And you can trace it back from Franklin Roosevelt, the critical figure, to his cousin Theodore Roosevelt. There were some differences between TR and FDR, but the younger man sort of worshipped the older Roosevelt and followed in his footsteps, literally one job after another.
That's true.
Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Vice President, Governor of New York, President. So FDR modeled himself on TR in many ways. And Theodore Roosevelt came out of the reform wing of the Lincoln Republicans from the Civil War. The Lincoln Republicans, when Abraham Lincoln, the subject of another one of my books, and what is kind of a series that includes my book, What Lincoln Believed, although this is a freestanding narrative history of the economy. Abraham Lincoln, when he was asked what he believed, he always said something like this. He said, "I am an old-fashioned Henry Clay Whig, W-H-I-G. Well, people may not remember the Whig Party, but Henry Clay was the dominant figure of the Whig Party versus the Democrats under Andrew Jackson in the first half of the 19th century. And he championed, as I describe in Land of Promise, this ambitious nation-building, economy-building system of national banking, federal financed infrastructure, federal support for manufacturing, which in turn goes all the way back as an agenda to Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury in the first presidential administration, that of George Washington. So over the last decade and a half or so, I've been piecing this tradition out.
So in some sense, tracing your roots.
Yes, and I tell people that it's because I am a Southerner from the heart of Jefferson Jackson territory that I'm such an ardent admirer of the Hamiltonians, because they've always the Hamiltonians, the ones who want a strong nation state, federal protection for civil rights, federal investment in infrastructure, have always been seen as the enemies by the local oligarchy in the South, which wanted local control of its workforce and no external interference, and was perfectly content to have a fairly primitive, backward, agrarian economy, or in the case of Texas, Louisiana, oil-exporting commodity economy. And so if you look at, you know, a lot of people, what I find is people from the West and the Northeast and the Midwest, they have these favorable associations of Jeffersonianism. It's the little guy and entrepreneurialism and so on. But if you look at the part of the country that was the most deeply imbued with Jeffersonian principles is the Deep South. It's the most backward, screwed up part of the country, you know, to this day. There's some Texas legislators. I used to work in the Texas legislature in my youth, who every year or so come up with a list of where the state of Texas, which is now the second biggest state in the union, is ranked on infant mortality, education, and things like that. And to some degree, as in the case of California, you do have a lot of unskilled and low-wage immigration. And it's sort of you can't really blame the system for not immediately digesting all of these folks, but it's still pretty disastrous. If you look at the parts of the country where you have the highest per capita GDP, the best school systems, and so on, they do come out of this older Hamiltonian, Whig, Lincoln Republican tradition. So in that sense, if you look at the Obama Democrats, their base now is in the Northeast and the Midwest and the West Coast, which was traditionally the heartland of this Hamiltonian tradition. And the Republicans, the parties have simply switched bases. The Republicans, which are the party of small government, states' rights, anti-statism, those were the traditional themes of the disciples of Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson. And appropriately enough, the Republicans are based where the Democrats were a century ago. Right. In the Deep South and in the plains and prairie states.
Yeah. You started this book a long time ago because, as you said, you were in your own South looking at where are my roots, where do I come from, where am I thinking at least. Putting it out at this moment, what is your hope?
Well, I argue in Land of Promise that the U.S. has had, in effect, three different republics under the same name of the United States of America and under the same formal constitution of 1788 that went into effect in 1789. In France, they're now on their fifth republic since the French Revolution in 1789. They're much more honest.
And they actually acknowledge them. So
they've had five republics, two empires, a directory, a consulate. So they're quite honest about this. There's an old joke about an American tourist who goes to a Parisian bookseller and he asks for a copy of the French Constitution. And the bookseller looks at him with great disdain and says, Monsieur, we do not sell periodical literature. But we pretend that we're still living under the system of 1787-88 that the founders came up with at Philadelphia. The Supreme Court, in practice, reinterprets things. So that we have it just as much radical change as the French or these other people go through multiple constitutions do.
And I would guess, I mean, just to comment on the moment, this particular Supreme Court, the majority in this particular Supreme Court seems to do radical things and claim more than ever.
Which is very interesting because in the 80s, original intent was the creed of the Federalist Society and of the conservative jurists, and they seemed quite as activist as any progressive jurists ever were. So I build in this book on a schema that I came up with in my earlier book, The Next American Nation, that we've had three republics, one from the founding. It fell apart in the Civil War, and then we rebuilt the Second Republic under Lincoln and his successors during Reconstruction. That lasted up until the Depression fell apart under Hoover. Franklin Roosevelt is really the founder of the Third Republic, in the 90s, I thought at some point there's going to be some crisis that does this third version of the United States in. And I think in 2008, with the global financial crash, much of the establishment in the United States still thinks this is a really bad recession. At some point, we will go back to the status quo ante 2008. It's not going to happen. That world is gone forever. Even the term recovery, I think, is a mistake. We should be talking about reconstruction.
Well, we'd have to come up with a new term, renewal.
Renewal.
Yeah.
But it's a matter of building a new system from
That's
the
right.
rubble.
That's
you know,
right.
It's not putting Humpty Dumpty back together.
Now, I've often thought that one of the reasons that I agree with you, and let me tell people, I'm Terrence McNally speaking with Michael Lynn. We're talking about the ideas in his book, Land of Promise and Economic History of the U.S. And to learn more, you can go to newamerica.net and look for Michael Lind, L-I-N-D.
From the movie Judgment at Nuremberg, the prosecution gives its opening statement.
The defendants served as judges during the period of the Third Reich. Therefore, you, Your Honors, as judges on the bench, will be sitting in judgment of judges in the dock. And this is as it should be. For only a judge knows how much more a court is than a courtroom. It is a process and a spirit. It is the house of law.
The defendants knew this, too. They knew courtrooms well. They sat in their black robes, and they distorted, they perverted, they destroyed justice and law in Germany.
The prosecution will please watch the light. The interpreter cannot follow you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. They distorted, they perverted, they destroyed justice and law in Germany. Now, this in itself is undoubtedly a great crime, but the prosecution is not calling the defendants to account for violating constitutional guarantees or withholding due process of law. The prosecution is calling them to account for murder, brutalities, torture, atrocities. They share with all the leaders of the Third Reich responsibility for the most malignant, the most calculated, the most devastating crimes in the history of all mankind. And they are perhaps more guilty than some of the others. For they had attained maturity long before Hitler's rise to power. Their minds weren't warped at an early age by Nazi teachings. They embraced the ideologies of the Third Reich as educated adults, when they, most of all, should have valued justice.
Well, here they'll receive the justice they denied others.
And now for something completely different.